This.
Hey, how you doing? What are you doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing?
Is Felger and Mads.
What?
On 98.5.
Unbelievable.
The Sports Hub.
I'll tell you, there's the feeling you get before these Bruins games are so much worse than any of the other teams here in town. There's just a looming dread. I mean, I don't know. Is that just me because I'm a Bruins fan? Like, is that or is there something about the quality of this team that lends to a different feeling before? But like, it's not fun.
No, it's definitely not fun.
It's not fun.
No,
this isn't fun.
No, part of it's them and part of it's the sport. I mean, because the games are just, you know, you're on edge the whole 2.5 hours at least. You're literally sitting there on the edge of your seat waiting for something bad to happen.
But are you feeling that way if you're a fan of the Pittsburgh Penguins, if you're a fan of another team?
Oh, I think so. I think I'm with Maz. I think it's the NHL playoffs, especially if you get an overtime in a Game 7. Oh, God. You can feel it taking years off your life, even if you're just watching as a neutral fan.
Okay, so here's a specific dread with this team, and I'm sorry, this goalie. And that is they've not been good in this spot. They have not been good in this spot in recent years. They have not. They just haven't. That's just a fact. It's not an opinion. It's not me opining. It's a fact. When Tuukka Rask has played a home elimination game in the playoffs, meaning his team is on the brink, facing elimination at home in the playoffs, his career record is 1-4. His goals against average is .333, and his save percentage is .872. That is so effing bad. Like, I can't even. 900 is, right, the number for goalie save percentage in today's NHL. 900. 872. He's 1-4, and the one win was the miracle comeback against Toronto, where you're down 3 goals with 5 minutes left. That's hardly, you know, Ken Dryden, 1970, shutting the door on you. That's just Tuukka Rask hanging on for dear life. Otherwise, he and the team in front of him has failed in every one of those spots. We also went and looked. Tuukka Rask, in his career, in the postseason, in elimination games of any kind, meaning any team, you know, either team, either the Bruins or the opponent faces elimination. So these are the highest of high leverage situations. You or the opponent are playing to either stay alive or go home. So Tuukka Rask, after the other night, because Game 6 was an elimination game, he's had two this series, has now played 20 of them in his career, 20. He is 6-14 with a .288 goals against and an .884 save percentage. Again, that blows. It blows. I don't want to blame him. I don't want to blame all him because he's not responsible for all goals. I'm just telling you that that's how they play in front of him. So I also thought it was fair just to go and say, well, how have the Bruins done historically in Game 7s? What's Bergeron's records in Game 7s? What's Chara's record in Game 7s? What's David Krejci's record in Game 7s? You know, are these guys, and how do they look? So we looked it up. Patrice Bergeron has played 9 Game 7s, 9. He has 4 goals, 2 assists, 6 points, and is a plus 4. His record, though, if you want to give him a record, is 4-5. So Patrice Bergeron has played 9 Game 7s, and he's only won 4 of them. Zdeno Chara, as you would imagine, has the exact same record, 4-5 with the Bruins. We didn't go back and look at his Ottawa or Islanders time. But with the Bruins, Chara in Game 7s is 4-5. David Krejci's 4-4 with no goals, 5 assists, and a plus 4. So David Krejci has played 8 Game 7s, has split them 4-4, and has not scored a goal in any of them. Those other numbers for Chara, I mean, I don't think he's... I'm not looking for him to put up offensive numbers, so I don't care that he's 0-2-2 in his 9 game sevens.
Plus minus means something, though, doesn't it?
He's even. Okay, he's even, and he's 4-5 in game sevens.
I mean, your best defenseman can't be even.
Bergeron is, again, a plus 4, 6 points in the 9 games. I mean, he has game-winning goals, to his credit, against Vancouver and, of course, Toronto, the ultimate clutch performance. So, I mean, I think it's on a lot of these guys. I don't think this team has been a great big-game team, which is almost impossible to say when they won a cup and went to another finals.
See, the numbers that stick out to me on that list are Chara. Those are the ones that stick out. Bergeron's a plus 4. Right? He's a plus... Krejci, plus 4. So those guys are offensive players, and they're producing more than they're allowing. And that doesn't even include power play, right? But nonetheless, those guys overall are giving you, in 9 games, 8 or 9 games, are giving you plus a half a goal, right? They're an advantage for you in those games. For Chara, your best defenseman, to be even? Like, now that goes hand in hand with Rask. So maybe that's where the breakdown is. Maybe in their own zone, you put a little pressure on them, and all of a sudden, those guys are cracking.
It's just, and this is what scares Bruins fans, and it should. If you've paid attention to the team over the years, you know you've been in this spot. At home, against a team you're better than, with every reason for you to win, and you don't come through. And so, like, I keep asking, what is it? What's the common denominator? Goalie's certainly one of them. Chara might be another. But yes, the thing is, I love Zdeno Chara, and I love Patrice Bergeron. I mean, I love them as players. Like, I think they are dedicated, hardworking, good pros, and I want them on my team, and I don't look at them. I don't look at those guys like I would look at Joe Thornton, you choking dog, or Alex Ovechkin, could never come through, or I don't know. I don't feel about those guys. Rick Nash. You know, I mean, I don't know. I feel they're winners.
But ish.
But I can't even say it without saying, I don't know. It's like their postseason failures outnumber their postseason successes by a pretty wide margin. And Matt Doloff did this at our website, 985thesportshub.com. He says, the further away you get from that 2011 magical run to the Cup, if you just take out that run where Tim Thomas was something else, he says, the more it looks like an outlier. It looks like that 2011 run was an outlier in their ability to finish teams off. Since the start of the 08 playoffs, the Bruins are 4-5 in Game 7s, but three of those came in 2011. So if you take out 2011, when Tim Thomas played like a, like an alien, they're 1-5 in Game 7s, going back to 2008. So this is Tim Thomas and Tuukka Rask. These are both guys. And since hoisting the cup in Vancouver, the Bruins are 1-2 in Game 7s, all at home. And again, the only win was when Toronto puked all over themselves in that Game 7. So this should really be 0-3.
An element that could be in play again tonight.
So, thank God. This is what I'm saying. You want to feel good about anything? You might be facing bigger choking pigs than you are. Tonight will mark the Bruins' first Game 7 since 2014, their second-round loss to the Canadiens. And that anticlimax of a series feels painfully similar to what's unfolding for the Bruins here. A wealth of opportunities and a woefully non-existent ability to capitalize on them. Again, Bruins were better than the Habs that year. Bruins ain't won the President's Trophy that year. Habs were the big underdog. You're at home in Game 7, no excuse. But in that Game 7, Marchand, Zdeno Chara, David Krejci, and Torrey Krug combined for two assists. As the Bruins potted only one power play goal on 30 shots. Tuukka Rask, meanwhile, allowed three goals on 18 shots. And in his other two Game 7s for the Bruins, he's allowed eight goals on 55 shots. For those scoring at home, that's a grand total of 11 goals on 73 shots, a save percentage of .849.
Oh, my God.
So, it's odd. It's not odd. It's just the Boohoo Tuukka crew never gives you those numbers. And, look, I'm not predicting the game. I'm not telling you. I don't want to hear this tomorrow. Blah, how do you like them now? I'm just telling you, this is the backdrop for the game. Their success in this spot, their success in front of Rask in this spot, it's on the line. If they lose it again tonight, if they drop another one of these, and Rask goes to 6-15 in elimination games, spread over, what is this now, 7 years, what do you think? What do you do?
Well, I don't know if he can move them and get equal value, but it might be worth it if you can just dump the money.
I mean, doesn't something have to change?
Sure. Yeah, look, to me, you start at the goalie. Put it this way, if you make other changes and you bring Rask back, how do you feel about it?
Who is the most at stake tonight?
Rask.
No, question about it. And you know what sucks for him? Is that coming through tonight doesn't really end it. At least not for me. I mean, you're not paid as the third highest paid goalie in the league to win one round. If you win tonight, that will be one series win in 4 years. It's like, so what is that?
For one night, you get to wipe your brow and say, whew, all right, let's see what happens in this next round.
But, dude, then you have the next round, yeah. And if you happen to get by that, then you're halfway home. So it's like, I don't think he has much to win other than keeping the dogs at bay and giving the 12 guys that think he's good who cover the team or who don't watch the team. I really think the Tuukka crew falls into two categories. The guys that cover the team who want to say fans are stupid for always blaming the goalie, and it's just like a snobby hockey writer thing, Like, you people are stupid. You always blame the goalie. Without really objectively looking at the goalie themselves, they just want to look down on the fans. That's one part of it. The other part of it is guys that don't really watch. I think the guys that don't really watch look at Tuca's numbers and say he's pretty good. But if you watched a lot, they wouldn't feel that way. Anyway, if Tuca wins tonight, he gets that crew a couple of days. Like, blah, how do you like him now?
Well, I guess he can do it. Oh, how do you like Tuca now? How are those numbers now, Felger?
Well, you got it after game four.
Okay, but
like
that,
you know, yeah, and it took one game to erase.
Like that proved anything. Exactly. It's more about one game and one round. It's the first round. If he comes through, you've gotten through the first round. I don't think it proves much, other than it keeps the dogs at bay for a couple of games. And you get to say, see, Tuca can do it. I think that's important for him. If he doesn't come through, it's a chorus line of something has to change, isn't it? Like so, there's like a ton at stake for him, but I don't know exactly how much he has to gain.
Well, he has some, not tonight. Yeah, is that what you mean?
Right, just tonight.
Yeah, no. He doesn't gain a ton tonight. But I just fear if it goes bad, you might be stuck with him. You're not going to get fair value in a trade. The only benefit would be to move the money.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Blood force drum!
Gonna run him right down their throat!
Felger.
I'm a hypocrite.
Mass.
Who cares?
Felger and Mass. 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Is there a kid playing outside road hockey? It's the seventh game and you're scoring a winning goal in overtime. That's just the way it was your whole life. I think, no one else in hockey is playing right now. They're all stopping to watch. And so that's always a seven. But I think just the opportunity, you get to go on. And, I think there's obviously a lot on the line that way. We'd like to play in the next round. If Boston wants to play in the next round, something's got to give. So, we're excited for the opportunity and enjoy the rest of today and be ready tomorrow.
This is a game that players dream about being in this situation. Game seven, playing road hockey in a small town in Canada or a big city in the United States or somewhere in between. And that's what it's about. Enjoy the moment. Prepare to play well. And we did that today. And I think we have throughout the series. And now you got to go out and embrace it. And to me, that's the simplest message we can give to our players. And do your job. Do it well. Trust the guy beside you. We've done it all year.
Felder and Mass, how you guys doing?
Good. What do you got?
Chara's, he's been solid his whole career here. I think he deserves another cup. He gives the leadership that you expect of him. Bergeron gives you the leadership and the play that you expect of him. But the only one that hasn't been kind of coming up, is, like you said, is Tuukka Rask. And, I mean, he has the tools to give you that big game, but when is he going to give us the big game? The other night he let a soft one go by for that first goal that, when it went up 1-1, and I knew at that moment the game was over. If he's the number three goalie in the league, he should be playing like the number three goalie because, Tampa Bay is going to be a tough team.
So let's not worry about Tampa till we get there. Tuukka Rask, in elimination games at home in his career, is 1-4. 1-4. If he goes to 1-5, look out. If he goes to 1-5, look out. Matt, in Boston, what do you got?
Michael, I'm pretty much in agreement with everything you said about the Bruins tonight and this series. I also agree with you with the fact that Tuukka and the star players like the Bergeron might have a lot to prove. But I'll tell you who has a big night in front of him tonight, and it's Bruce Cassidy. I am a big fan of Bruce Cassidy, and I'm glad that when they made the coaching change that they did. But if they lose this game tonight, the honeymoon's over for Bruce Cassidy because the last two games he's had been run circles around him by Mike Babcock. And there's going to be a lot of second guessing on his part as far as why didn't you play Ryan Donato? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? They lose tonight, the honeymoon's over for Bruce, in my opinion.
Okay, fair enough. I would agree with that. He's done something really interesting tonight. He's gone back to a lineup that they ran out for whatever, 90% of the time when everyone was healthy. Like, this is the lineup. This is it. This is Rick Nash, David Krejci, and Jake DeBrusk. This is the reunited third line that was great for so many parts of the year. Riley Nash, David Backes, and Danton Heinen. And then that great fourth crash line with Achari, Corrali, and Tim Schaller. Like, it's all together. This is it. And, he's done some tinkering in between, and he's a tinkerer. Yet tonight he said, I'm going with the lineup that brought us. How do you feel about that, man?
So I generally hate that mentality. I can't stand it. And I'll tell you why. Because it's one thing to do it during the regular season when it's over the long haul and you're playing dog teams some nights. And frankly, even the good teams probably are playing at 80%, like in terms of intensity level. So when you get to the postseason, to me, this is precisely the point where you have to look at specific matchups and what works and what doesn't work. And you have to be willing to change things. So again, this is elementary. But if Babcock just kept running the same lines out there with the same matchups, would he put Plekanec on Bergeron earlier in the series? Like, no. He saw an adjustment change he had to make.
Well, so Fluto Shinzawa just wrote something at The Athletic that I thought was good. The only reason Plekanec ended up on Patrice Bergeron is because
Kadri was out.
Yeah. So it's not like Babcock came up. That was sort of necessity is the mother of invention sort of thing. But either way.
How about the penalty kill in Toronto?
There's certainly been adjustments from Babcock that have worked. I mean, he could have put someone else up on Bergeron, and he chose Plekanec, and that was the right call. This is a decision. You know, they've had trouble finishing, and one of their best finishers is going to pretty much sit out the entire series in Ryan Donato.
I just think that to say we're going to go with what got us here, that line to me is a cop-out, right? That is, well, we won all year with it. Why would I stop doing it now? That line's a cop-out, and it either means you don't know what to do, or you don't feel like you have any options.
Ed and Woodburn.
One or the other.
Ed and Woodburn, give me a Bruins thought.
First off, you guys make it sound like Claude Julien's still coaching the team and Brian Gionta is going to be in the lineup. But more importantly, Jay Stu, you get some tickets for tonight because I know you're undefeated in Game 7. But lastly is this. David Krejci, if he turns the puck over 2 feet inside of the offensive blue line again tonight, I'm going to lose my mind. The key to the game, like you guys have been saying all night long, get the puck in deep, hit the defenseman, grind it out, make them play the whole length of the ice, and we'll be fine. Everyone needs to pump the brakes on the panic button here.
Okay, I hope you're right, Ed. Krejci's another one, I think, that if he has donuts tonight and they lose and he's a big part of it, that, you know, there's a groundswell for, you know, that's enough of David Krejci. I think it would be fair. Now, I think you're in the same spot with Krejci as you are with Rask. What are you going to get for him? A lot of money for a guy who's clearly on the back side. But that's another one with a lot to prove. Here's another one with a lot to prove. Ed in Somerville. Go ahead, Ed.
So, with the trade for Rick Nash, wasn't this exactly what we're going to...
Yes, that's another guy. I'll just finish it for you. Rick Nash is another guy with a lot to prove.
Yes, now look, I'm glad he's back with Krejci again. I like him and Backes split up. I don't like the two of them together. I know they played fairly well in the last game. I still like Nash with Krejci. Like, to me, he needs a big guy. He needs someone to create some space for him. But Nash is starting to feel like Joe Thornton to me.
Oh,
I said that to you in an email the other day.
Yeah, that's his best buddy.
Oh, it fits.
They're buddies.
Perfect. Great. Well, there you go. He's Joe Thornton. Terrific. Like, you know, again, a guy with that size that plays smaller. It just irritates the crap out of you.
Cam and Taunton. Hi, Cam.
I honestly don't know what to expect tonight because I like to believe that this team is different because there's more skill on this team than pretty much any Bruins team of yours and my lifetime. But it's like I could see them winning 5-1. I could see them losing 5-1. I would feel better if this game was in Toronto because almost all the Game 7s you've lost since you become relevant again, which I started in 2008, their series against Montreal, they've all been at home. You lost a Game 7 in Montreal that year, but then you lost a Game 7 at home to Carolina, to Philly, to Montreal, to Washington. I would feel better if it was in Toronto. And I don't get this. Donato, why is he not in the lineup tonight? You get the last change. You can keep him out of defensive situations. What do you got to lose, Bruce? What?
Because, okay, I mean, I can explain it to you. Donato does not fit at all on the third or fourth line. And he's not going to go play with Bergeron, Marchand, and Pastrnak. So there's only one place for him, and that's David Krejci. David Krejci has Jake DeBrusk on his left side. Ryan Donato, they've said a million times, can't play the right side right now. He can center, and he can play left, but he can't play right wing. So,
No, you got it right. He can't play on the right side.
Play on the right side.
Yeah, and Cassidy talked about it. He said that the versatility of Heinen gives him more flexibility if they're going to mix things up in the game.
The only play is to play Ryan Donato at left wing with David Krejci and move Jake DeBrusk down to the third line and boot Heinen out of there. Okay? That's the only option. I mentioned that 2 weeks ago. It's the only thing they could do. And they don't want to do it. So, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, Jake DeBrusk has been one of your best players. I don't think he deserves to move down.
No, I wouldn't move DeBrusk.
So there's no spot for him.
So I'd play Donato in place of Heinen, and I'd keep on the left side. That's what I would do.
What about what he brought up if this game was being played in Toronto? Would you feel a little bit more comfortable? I know I would. I said it yesterday.
Explain.
I just feel like, I mean, look, just based on the history and the two that I've been to here in recent years, I was here against Carolina in that second round in 09, and that game seven against Washington a few years later. You can feel the tightness of the building as soon as you walk into it. Going to be a lot of heavy drinking tonight. And that's, I think, just to try to calm the nerves.
Felger and Maz.
Oh, I like this.
This is Felger and Maz.
Part of me wants to do it just to feel what that feels like.
98.5. The Sports Hub.
Sports Hub.
The Sports Hub.
The Sports
Hub. Brock Holt with a double and a single tonight.
Line drive, base hit. Devers is in. Nunez trying to score. Here's the play at the plate. He is going to be tagged out at home. The Red Sox have tied the ball game, however. Nunez out at home on the play at the plate, but Brock Holt with his third hit has tied it at 3 in the ninth.
Count 2-0 on Granderson. High fly ball, right field. This is deep. Way, way back, and that's the ball game. Granderson jumping on Craig Kimbrell's pitch for a walk-off home run.
They just know, man. They know when something bad's going to happen for the team, and it's like, cut it. So anyway, those are two plays worth second-guessing, sending home Eduardo Nunez on a game-tying hit from Brock Holt in the ninth, and then Kimbrell giving up the game-winning home run to Granderson in the 10th or 11th, whatever it was. Your thoughts, Mass?
Okay, so when the runner getting thrown out of the plate, Nunez, to me, two outs in that situation, like, that's one of those. If you go by the book, you wave him in, you make the guy make the throw.
Are you kidding?
Okay.
That's the book?
The book.
To run on that. On a one-hopper to the left fielder in shallow left field.
Particularly Granderson, who doesn't throw well. So
No. But that was a bullet.
I know what it was. I saw it.
It was like one or two hops.
I'm just telling you what the book is.
I'm going to stop you. There is no book that says send the runner, who's not even at the base yet, when the left fielder on a laser gets a one or two hopper. No, that's not the book.
If there's two outs and it's the winning run or the go-ahead run, the general logic is make him throw you out.
If the book says that, the book should be burned. If that's the book, I will use the book as toilet paper.
The book should be flushed down the toilet. I mean, is that what you're telling
me? Come on, he had no shot.
Okay, so look, Granderson doesn't throw well. So again, I'm telling you, if you go by that, okay? But I would tell you that they make bad decisions a lot on the bases. I mean, from Fabelis to the runners themselves, and I look at this now, and they're still number one in the majors and outs on the bases. You got Mookie Betts coming up.
Okay, so thank you. That's why I want it. Mookie Betts is sitting there on the on-deck circle.
Correct.
That doesn't mean something, too?
Sure it does. Absolutely it does. Again, I'm telling you, if you go by what the book is, again, this is the cop-out answer. Like, I feel like I'm talking about Bruce Cassidy now and then keeping the lineup. The cop-out is two outs, you go for it there if you've already tied the game. If it's, you know, the tying run, well, then, you know, maybe you might have to play it a little more delicately. But you got one of your best hitters coming up next. To me, if you read the situation, they're on turf. The guy could bounce the ball home, for crying out loud. I'd have held him up. But, I just think given the cop-out answer that you will get, be prepared for that answer.
Kimbrel in the 10th.
So I didn't love that, and I'll tell you why. Okay, I know he was up warming. I know that they rallied to tie the game. I know all of that. But generally speaking, on the road, I don't like bringing your closer in. Not at this time of year. Okay, not at this time of year. You want to do it in a big game or something later in the year, fine, yes. In a home game, you absolutely use him in a tie game. Absolutely 100% you go to him there. But to me, again, I just feel like the bigger takeaway, look, Kimbrel was really good in tie games last year, and Farrell used him on the road on occasion, and he did well in it. We just looked it up. He went unbeaten, and he had a 0.64 ERA in non-save situations last year. And I remember Farrell using him on the road in tie games. Okay, so all well and good. The bigger takeaway for me is Cora in the bullpen. I feel like he's all over the place a little bit, and he's trying to figure it out. So I know that Kimbrel was up, but you just put him in because you had him up? Like, so if he gave you an inning, were you going to use him for two? Were you not going to use him for two? Who's going to get the next inning? You still had Smith available. Kelly had already pitched, so you still had Barnes available. You could have kept Kimbrel loose in some capacity without necessarily bringing him into the game.
So, again, that's a big part of it. They don't want to burn him. He was up throwing in the ninth, and you don't want to send him back down and burn him with just warm-up throws. You want to use him.
Right, and he hadn't pitched in a while. But I still look at that and say, I'm holding him out for a save situation there. I'm not that fearful of the Toronto lineup. But again, the game-to-game stuff, fine. Like, we can quibble over decisions every night. But the bigger picture to me when I look at the bullpen is I say, Carson Smith didn't come in for Price over the weekend. Kimbrel came in the ninth last night, but he couldn't pitch the eighth earlier in the year. Bobby Pointer didn't come in on opening day to face lefties, but a day later he did. And I feel like Cora is searching. So I don't think he's figured out the bullpen yet.
Just real quick, though, do you think he's familiar with Craig Kimbrel in non-save situations? Because I can't say I was all that surprised when Granderson hit that home run.
Me neither, because I still have it in my mind from 2 years ago when he sucked in those situations.
So 2 years ago, he was 2-4 with a 5.2 ERA in non-saves. But last year, he was dynamite.
See, I blame Kimbrel, because I feel like he's one of these guys that's just save-dependent. You know, I feel like they're reluctant to use him in the eighth because he needs his save. And if he has to go 1 1/3 or 1 2/3, he may not get there. And you've burned him, and he's not going to get a save. And don't put me in tie games because that's not a save. I feel like he's obsessed.
Hey, that stain of 2 years ago is still stuck in my head.
Me too. I mean, and I feel like maybe he's just one of those guys, sort of selfish. The selfish closer that saves situations, or I'm not the same guy.
I mean, so look, they all are, and I hate that. But last year, 3-0, 0.64, with 51 strikeouts and 28 innings in non-saves.
It's pretty good. All right, back to your phones. Chris in California has been waiting on the Celtics. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Michael. Hey, my call's on the C's, but real quick on the Bruins. Bergie needs to factor in the game tonight as far as star play in order for them to win. If the B's go down by 2 goals, I'm shutting the TV off. So this brings me to my first point. Horford moving to the 5 last night, Semi going to the 4 and guarding Giannis. That was the key coaching to the game by Stevens last night. It was genius. Secondly, maybe I should pivot my green teamer question to Murray. I think you and Tony completely whiffed and missed the volleyball spike at the net from your first caller. I think it was Luke from Vermont. You failed to capitalize on the herd Celtics prediction as NBA champs next year. Cullen went on his usual Celtics rant this morning. Is the re-addition next year of Kyrie and Hayward enough, or do you still think we're one trade piece away?
See, it's not good enough next year. If you want to tell me ultimately...
I think that they're going to win the East next year if everyone stays healthy.
Me too. I think they lose in 5 to Golden State. I mean, I hate to predict an NBA Finals 2 years from now, but that's what I'm doing. If you want to tell me in the next 3 to 5 years, that Brown and Tatum grow up enough to complement Kyrie and Hayward, and Golden State, you know, has to lose a body or two, okay. Is that going to be good enough next year to beat Golden State?
Probably not. I mean, again,
and we don't even know where LeBron goes. If LeBron goes to Philadelphia, you might not get out of the East.
Well, so that's true. Yep, that is true. I'm telling you, though, I think Tatum and Brown are just scratching the surface. I do. I think in a year or two, these guys are going to be good. It's going to happen faster than you think it's going to because they're already there earlier. The timeline with them. And the other thing is, doesn't feel like the league is getting younger? There are more good dominating players in the league now than there have ever been. And I don't know that. So I don't know. Maybe this is a trend in sports overall.
How many championship ones are there? That's what we're talking about.
Okay. I'm just telling you.
Because the championships have been veterans against LeBron. That's what it's been.
True. Okay, true. This was a great draft. It wouldn't surprise me if you start seeing some young championship teams in the next 2 or 3 years.
Okay, it'd be a first, because that's generally not how... I mean,
it would be a first.
I mean, Golden State's as close as it gets 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but Steph Curry, I think, was in his 7th year or something?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that.
So I don't know if you appreciate how just kids don't win.
No, I do appreciate that kids don't win. I'm telling you that I think the league may be changing. That's what I'm telling you. The kid in Utah is playing out of his mind in the playoffs. Embiid is taking over. Now, granted,
I think Philadelphia is the best example right now that they were able to really not just win but dominate this first round series and likely will be favorite. I would think be the favorite against the Celtics in round two. They're the example to look at.
Now, look again. Team. We're in the first round.
Yeah,
we're not in the finals.
Thank you.
So we'll see what happens later on. But I'm telling you, the Celtics are getting close.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
It's Felger and Mazz on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Follow these guys on Twitter at Felger and Mazz.
Lamar Jackson, we've talked about the Patriots, and maybe they go outside the box for a Tom Brady number two here with Jimmy Garoppolo gone. They actually had Lamar Jackson in their building recently.
Lamar Jackson slings it deep. Oh, my goodness, what a pass. Touchdown, Jalen Smith. He made that
Baldwin easy throwing that 75-yard bullet.
There have been some rumors over the last couple weeks about how much the Patriots like him, and then they trade Brandon Cooks to the Rams, and you say, well, maybe they could take a quarterback now that they had the extra first-round pick. He was the only top quarterback that they had in the building. They didn't have Josh Rosen or Josh Allen or Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, any of those guys. It was just Lamar Jackson.
Keeps it himself. Got a nice block. Hello, Lamar Jackson. Touchdown, Cards.
Yes, the Patriots will consider taking Lamar Jackson as Tom Brady's successor.
So that's Ian Rappaport there. Multiple reports of the Patriots' real interest in Lamar Jackson. We all know that they brought him in for a visit, but it was reported today by the Monday Morning Quarterback that they also held a private workout with Lamar Jackson, with Josh McDaniels down in Florida. So they've had two private workouts with him. The reports that they're interested and intrigued, and they've been linked to this player for a while. And Josh traveled to South Florida. They brought him up to Foxborough.
Was Josh wearing pants during this second meeting?
Why do you ask?
I mean, I'm with Maz on this. This is what he lusts for, based on when he chose Tim Tebow in the first round, when he had the one chance of being a head coach in Denver. There, ooh, a guy that won the Heisman, a guy with mobility. Oh yes.
So you think this is for real? It's not a smoke screen.
I do. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, the two visits is a tip off. I mean, if they looked at him and said, "No, this guy just doesn't have it," they wouldn't look at him again. They wouldn't. That's an awful lot to go through for a smoke screen. Okay. Also, Jim Louthy, who's down here engineering for us today, made a good point. You know, which one came first? Which visit came first? Bill up in Foxborough or Josh down in Florida? Because that would make a difference, right? It would be more meaningful if they met with Bill first, wouldn't it? Because Bill would then be saying to Josh, this kid can play. You should take a look at him. Because, you know,
this is going to be your guy.
You're going to get him. If Josh looked at him first and then called Bill, is that as meaningful? Because
no.
Isn't Bill likely to go, all right, Josh, yeah, okay, sure, yeah, I'll look at him. Good job. go work out Tebow next. You know what I mean? So do we know which came first?
Well, according to Pro Football Talk, the workout in Florida came first.
Okay, so I think that's less meaningful, don't you?
Instinctively, yes. But I wonder who ultimately is going to get the say on the quarterback. Like, if Bill's out of town here in a year, and the Crafts want Josh to pick the quarterback, again, it felt to me like there was a big campaign there during the, you know, late in the season when everything was going down, that after the Garoppolo trade, it was pointed out, well, that McDaniels had something to do with that anyway. He's really the guy on the quarterbacks. If McDaniels has the latitude to actually pick and develop the guy, I don't know. The bottom line is, they're serious about the kid, I think.
You feel that way?
I do, because it's two visits. To get on a plane and go down there and see him, that's a big-time commitment. That's a big-time commitment. You want the kid to come up and see you, fine, no problem. They do that with lots of players. You waste your time in the year. We're not wasting ours. When you get here, let us know. We'll have you in and out of here. Okay? But the rest of the time, we got stuff to do. So, but on this one, you put the offensive coordinator and probably the next head coach on a flight to go down there and see him. To me, they're serious about him. So now I'm starting to wonder, you know,
There's a tweet here in the last.
Okay, so exactly.
Yes.
Louthy or someone, if someone would just read this recent Rappaport tweet, please.
Yeah, just about 15 minutes ago, note on the Patriots, with two first-round picks and interest in a possible top-flight quarterback, they have more than enough ammo to move up in the first round. They are viewed as a team to watch coming up for a passer, depending on who falls.
Okay, so all this smoke about the Patriots and a quarterback and Lamar Jackson, you feel it's legit?
I do.
Okay, so that's on the board.
Do you?
Yes. Lamar Jackson, I don't know. Lamar Jackson, I don't know. He had a 50% completion passer or more, ran more than he threw at Louisville. Like, oh, God, are they really going to? I mean, I'm all for a little more mobility at the position. I think that's a trend in the league, and I think moving is good and all of that. And the read option is seeping into the NFL a little bit. But to the point where I want to go for a guy who college threw under 60% and ran more than he threw, too much. And I it's too much for them. I don't think that. I think it's – Josh may be interested, but at the end of the day – and, you know, this whole other dynamic is that the Crafts are going to say to Josh, you pick the quarterback, not Bill, even though it's a project for the next 2 to 3 years. Like, that's another one. That's going to go over like a wet fart in Belichick's office. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
So, look, I'm not telling you that I know for sure that that's what's happening.
Okay, here's what I think. No, so, I mean, let me. That was a long answer. I think they're going to draft Kyle Laletta in the third or fourth round. They're going to stand pat, and they're going to take the kid whose dad went to Navy and whose uncle went to Navy and cross paths with Steve Belichick, and the kid that plays the cross, they're going to wait until the third round. They're just going to stand pat, and they're going to take the guy there. That's what they're going to do. Everything else is bullcrap.
I still think there's a chance they take two. I do, oh, and God. I'm wondering if now if there is some real possibility of them moving up. Like, I do. I wonder about that. Mike, there are a lot of connections with Louisville, right? Petrino's offense. Mike Lombardi's kid was on the staff over there, for crying out loud. They visited with him twice. I mean, again, that's a lot of connections for it to be bullcrap.
Okay, let's follow up on that Red Sox thought with a few quick calls here. Roger in Manchester, go.
Hey, guys, I put the onus on last night's loss on Alex Cora in the ninth inning last night. When Eduardo Nunez hit the ball to right center field in the gap, I thought for sure he was going to be on second base. He runs on first and third. Then he stole second base. I think Nunez, when he came around third last night, if you can look at it again, Maz, look at his right knee, what kind of pressure he's putting on that knee when he makes that turn. We had Tijon Lin in the dugout, could have used him as a pinch runner in the ninth inning, and I think he would have scored.
Okay, hold on. Nunez should have been pinch run for. That's point one. Here's point two. Bob in Marble. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, Maz, you were right about that's a book rule about the guy touched third base. When the left fielder gets the ball, you send him and score and rely on that. Also, they wouldn't have pinched to Mookie Best at the end there. They would have intentionally walked him.
Okay, and then the bases would have been loaded for who was in the two hole last night?
Benintendi.
So take my chances there.
Sure, yeah. Again, there's no reason to walk away from that. You got confidence in Benintendi.
Should Nunez have been pinch run for?
No. No. I mean, it didn't even cross my mind. No. And look, I tell you, he's not moving like he did last year when he got here. So I don't know that he has the same, you know, I'm worried more about his defense than I am anything else. But he was out by a mile on that play. I don't think it would have mattered who was running.
Okay, you know my line about when we go to Red Sox callers, Maz. It's so true.
Oh, yeah. Put your teeth in before you call.
Sounds like they just put their teeth in. They just woke up from the afternoon nap and put their teeth in.
Put my dentures in before I make this call.
Yeah, I love you. I mean it. Respect you, man. Call us, and we'll talk it. I'm just telling you, I think the Red Sox thing hits the older demo. That's all I'm saying.
Stay tuned for more Felger and Maz on 98.5 The Sports Hub.